Good evening and a warm welcome to this evening's session. We seem to have the rain, and I assume that for many of us it's a sign of a blessing. So hopefully that would start for me that's spiritual. I think that's a very good sign in terms of the kinds of discussions that we're going to be having today. I think the people have seen in the news and have heard, and I think there's quite a big buzz about the fact that Eskom is said to be unbundled. We know for those of us who are from South Africa in particular that energy or municipal services in particular have since 2000 up to now been going through major contestations around privatization, commercialization of our services. We now have, despite our so-called democracy, which we all seem to be having really difficulty coming to terms with, we see our services in particular, those that are perceived as being, or as we understand it to be, public sector services, strongly being pushed towards privatization. We now have a worse form where our public utility, despite its, itself being plagued by high levels of corruption, government is now saying, well, in effect, what we need to do is just unbundle it, resolve the problem, we won't hold our comrades accountable, and let's just privatize. So we have tonight quite an esteemed panel. We have Daniel Chavez on my left, and I'm just using left and right with no political innuendos. Brian, who's the executive director of AIDC and obviously the host of the seminar, to my right. And then Sean Sweeney on the extreme right. So just to give a brief... No political
at all. I'll be moving.
But hopefully the input will be out or left.
Yeah.
Okay, so just to give a brief introduction, so I'm your host or your chair for this evening, facilitator. I'm Hamida from Naledi, which is the research arm for COSATU. And obviously, being COSATU, I'm in quite a difficult position, right? But I think the key issue is that, fortunately, from the research that AIDC is doing, it's NUMSA and NUM that are with AIDC trying to do a really good piece of research to do reflections on how we actually keep ESCOM public. And I think in terms of organization and being able to hold government accountable, we're in quite a difficult alliance. But hopefully we can, in situations like this, use whatever power is left for us within the union to be able to leverage something. So we hope that quite a lot would be leveraged from the piece of research. And maybe a special thank you to Brian for not letting go of the unions and having and seeing some positivity in the utility that we still hold as a formation. So Daniel Chavez is a fellow with TNI, and he's currently based in Amsterdam, and he's done a lot of research on the public sector, but specifically in electricity. And I think the large part or the essence of the discussion that we're going to have is to look at how you actually maintain the public sector or a public utility as a public utility, and where there's been contestation or move towards having it privatized, what were some of the efforts to actually remunicipalize or democratize or take away or bring it back into the hands of the public sector. So I'll hand over to you then. You've got about 20 minutes.
Okay.
I'm using a PowerPoint presentation, so we'll move out of the way.
So, thank you again for the invitation to come to Cape Town. It's always a pleasure to be back here. And I met some of you in a similar workshop that we had last year when we began to work together around ESCOM. I gave a presentation at that moment. Some of the slides that you will see now, those of you who came to the seminar will remember from that time. But I tried to incorporate also some new information that maybe is relevant for the conversation that we need to have here in South Africa. I have to clarify from the beginning that I'm not going to talk about ESCOM because I just arrived in South Africa, and a lot has happened in the country, and in particular around ESCOM since the last time I was here. So I haven't had the time to read everything that has been appearing in the newspaper, in the South African media about ESCOM, and I haven't had the time to follow in detail the debate that is going on among trade unionists, academics, government officials, and other people interested in the future of ESPAR. So I will just look at the international context. And I will try to refer mainly to three things. To provide some ideas for discussion around the energy transition, also to try to say something about the importance of energy democracy, and more important, to stress the relevance, the importance, the need of public ownership. So I will structure my presentation in three parts. First, I'm gonna be talking about energy transition, and I pose that as a question mark because I'm not so sure that we are going through an energy transition. And I'm sure Sean agrees with me. For this part, I took a lot of information and analysis that has been produced by TUET. So maybe during the question and comments time, Sean can elaborate a bit more about the response to this question. First of all, we need to be aware that private renewable options cannot displace fossil fuels and bring about a full-on energy transition. Even though there is a lot of hype about the importance of the private sector internationally, the international empirical evidence shows that the private sector is not the solution to solve the climate problem anywhere in the world, and it's not the solution in particular in the energy sector. And why we need the energy transition is because the planet is warming, and it's warming up quite awfully. And this was clear, and I don't know why the slides are not playing, by a recent report that has been produced by the UN. It was published in October 2018, just before the big climate conference in Poland. And it shows the importance of just half degree warming. That might not seem a big deal, moving from, we already warm almost 2 degrees, to warm a bit more, it wouldn't be so important. But this report is really worrisome because it shows, for instance, that when we look at the Arctic summer sea ice, and here we should be seeing the transition in the transparency, but it doesn't show, we see that with a warming of 1.5 degrees, sea ice will remain during most summer. So there will be some ice. But if we move to 2 degrees warming, there is 10 times more likely possibility that there will be no sea ice during the summer. So maybe that's not so important for those of us who come from the south, but it is very important. And when we look at other aspects of this warming, it shows that it's much more problematic for all of us. Here we could see in the presentation that we don't see, I see in my computer, but you don't see it there, heat waves. And heat waves are happening all over the world. And if we have a 1.5 warming, about 14% of the population is expected to be affected by these heat waves that are happening almost everywhere, every summer. In Europe, a lot of people are dying because of the heat wave. And the same happens in other regions of the world. But if we move to 2 degree warming, about 37% of the world population is gonna be affected by heat waves. Oh, there we can see the heat wave. More important, for a city like Cape Town, that has a lot of water scarcity, I've been following all the problems that you had last year here in Cape Town, and it shows with this report showed that with 1.5 degree warming, about 350 million of the population will be affected by water scarcity. But if we move to 2 degrees warming, more than 400 million people will be affected by water scarcity. So the need for a transition is something urgent for all of us, and in particular for people like you who really suffer about this kind of problem. But for some people, apparently there is not such an urgency because they argue that the transition is already happening. For instance, I took this quote from a report published by TUET, and you all know Al Gore. He has been talking about climate for many years. And he said, yeah, we are a bit behind, But the momentum has shifted. We are seeing energy renewable being deployed all over the world, and in fact, we are winning, he says. So there's a lot of positive news that this guy is apparently bringing. And you all know Ban Ki-moon. He's not longer in his post, but he was also very optimistic. He said that we have entered a new era, that the progression of low emission growth is inevitable, unavoidable, and is already underway. In fact, it is not unavoidable, and it's not already underway, as we can see in a minute. And even some of our allies tend to share this kind of hype about the energy transition. For instance, Jennifer Morgan from Greenpeace argues that the energy revolution is already underway, that renewable energy is breaking global record while coal is entering a terminal decline, and that we just need to speed up. We would all love that all these positive news were true, and they are partly true, as we can see. But the deep of the transition, the expansion of no transition, is by no means as big as it should be required to stop climate change. And more recently, we see even some governments that share this hype. For instance, in the United States, the governor of California appeared quite often in the news because apparently he's pushing for a clean energy transition. And he said that there is no real reason to worry because the energy transition is a moral necessity and makes perfect economic sense. The numbers show that the energy transition doesn't really make always such an economic sense, as we are going to see in a minute. And this leads us to this assumption that market-driven energy policy has not advanced renewables, but in fact impeded their development. And we can even see it in some of the countries that are supposedly most advanced in terms of the energy transition. I guess you all heard about the German energy transition that is usually portrayed as a model. But in fact, when we look at the use of coal, we see that Germany still remains the largest burner of coal in the whole of Europe. So yeah, there is more renewable, but Germany is burning more coal than before, despite the transition. And when we look at the global picture, we see that the proportion of the different sources of energy in the global picture has not really changed. For instance, in red, we see oil and gas, and we see that there have been some ups and downs, but it's the same. And when we look at non-fossil energy, in fact, we see that we are not winning, we are not advancing, because the planet doesn't really worry about how many windmills or solar panels are there, as long as we don't stop burning fossil fuels. And when we look at power generations more in particular, we see that in fact renewables are going up and they are expected to continue going up, but the problem is that the amount of coal, gas, nuclear, petroleum, that is this burn, it's also going up. So, yeah, we all need more renewable, but this is not enough. So, what we see today is that since the whole energy market is controlled by private interests, we see that the investments in renewables are already falling. And there has been a report by the International Energy Agency that shows this, that the market is not really so much interested in the renewable sector because it's not really as profitable as before. Obviously, we are talking about the international picture. The situation in different countries can be different. So another assumption is that reaching climate targets would require decisive public action, beginning with the abolition of competitive electricity markets. And this is because the global energy markets are going through major policy shifts. For instance, I live in Europe. There was a lot of excitement in previous years about feed-in tariffs, but the European Commission and European government are phasing out feed-in tariffs, so they are no longer a concrete alternative. And at the same time, and this is worrisome, we see the expansion of public-private partnership that in fact are always more private than public, and thus there's a lot of empirical evidence, international empirical evidence that show us, and power purchase agreement that is, are a particular form of public-private partnership in the electricity sector, and there is a lot of competitive bidding. And this is a global trend. When we look at the map of the world, we see that PPAs and PPPs are almost everywhere, and we can see in this map in green. And there are a lot of countries that have not yet incorporated this kind of mechanism, but are planning to introduce them in the near future. So a lot of people internationally are seeing the private sector as the solution, when in fact the private sector is not the solution. And this is not an ideological assumption, this is based on numbers, on concrete evidence from different countries, because competitive bidding leads to a fall in the rate of profits. And the market, if they cannot make money out of it, will not be so willing to continue investing in the power sector, in the renewable segment of the power sector. And we see this fall of investment in renewable all over the world. For instance, this is a graphic here from Europe, but TUE has produced a lot of reports, and they had found almost the same picture anywhere in the world. So the private sector is not the solution. And in fact, this has been acknowledged by a recent report produced by the International Energy Agency that shows that market-based and subsidized low-carbon investment have been negligible. So the private sector is not really being the solution as a lot of people think they are. And this has shown that we are in real problem because, for instance, when we look at the situation of Europe, the place where I live, a small portion of the European state are on track to meet the Paris goal that were not ambitious goals. In fact, we need much more than what was agreed in Paris to revert or stop climate change. So very quickly to the second part, what is energy democracy? I'm gonna be very quick here because there's a lot of material that is out there on the web. There are a lot of publications easily accessible that shows the current discussion about energy democracy. But energy democracy is not just a transition to more renewable. It's much more than that kind of transition. And this was put very clear in a report produced by Sean and his colleagues at the Trade Union for Energy Democracy that was produced already 3 or 4 years ago.
2012.
Where they talked that energy democracy implies a decisive shift in power towards workers, community, and the public. That's energy democracy. It's not just a transition to renewable energy. And they summarized that process around the idea of resist, reclaim, and restructure. And when they talk about restructure, they mean basically restructuring the public sector, thinking about public ownership. So, very quickly, the other idea that we have to consider when we talk about energy democracy is that it basically means greater democratic control of energy system. And so far, we have been talking only about electricity. But energy democracy means a much deeper discussion about all the different components of the energy system, not just electricity. And this was clear, for instance, in the resistance that a lot of different organizations conducted in the US a few years ago against a pipeline that crossed indigenous territory. And that meant a big alliance of indigenous people, trade unions, community organizations, environmental organizations, and so on. So to finalize the part about energy democracy, I want to stress the need of adapting the concept of energy democracy to the peculiar condition and needs of the South. Because I feel that sometimes we had a very romantic understanding of what energy democracy means. For instance, in Europe, most of the publication about energy democracy show this kind of picture. A kind of ideal where communities get together, they put some solar panels, they put a windmill, and that's energy democracy. And in fact, this is energy democracy also, but it is not enough, because the scope of climate change as a problem is so deep that just by having community power, we are not going to solve the problem. We need to put the state public ownership in a big level in the overall picture. And we also see that many of the energy cooperatives that have expanded, for instance, in Europe, are now in problem, because when the whole energy market changes, when the whole institutionality that made these cooperative possibles change, they also have problems, because they need to operate within a market system. And the market system is not conceived to respond to the needs of this kind of community organization, but to respond to the needs of big capital. So to finalize, I want to address the issue of why public ownership matters. And it matters for a very simple reason. We have a lot of empirical evidence from many countries around the world that shows that privatization has failed. And it is not by chance that public ownership is back in the political agenda. For those of you who are interested in this subject, I would recommend you to look at a special issue that this magazine, The New Internationalist, published last year, that showed many positive examples of remunicipalization, renationalization, of the electricity sector, the water sector, the sanitation sector, health, education, etc., that are happening all over the world, not only in the global south, but also in rich countries of Europe, US, Canada, Australia, and Japan. And we recently put together this book that was produced by several organizations, including TNI, but also labor organizations such as PSI, that shows from how people in many different geographic and political contexts are reclaiming the ownership and management of essential public services such as water and electricity as a way to respond to people's basic needs, but also as a way to respond to environmental challenges. And there are some very positive news that we found out when we were looking at this picture. And we see that the trend towards deprivatization or towards republicization, as some of us prefer to call it, is a global trend. And we found thousands of examples of deprivatizations in the energy, transport, healthcare, social work, education, local services, water, and waste services from very different countries from around the world. If you are interested in this research, it's all available online, and I will give you the link at the end of this presentation. And to finalize, I wanted to refer to two positive examples of public ownership in the energy sector, and those are the cases of Uruguay and Costa Rica. And I mentioned the case of Uruguay, not only because I come from there, because a lot of people are looking at the example of Uruguay. For instance, around the summit of Paris in 2015, The Guardian published a special issue looking at what they call the Uruguayan energy revolution. Now, almost 50% of the Uruguayan power needs are covered by wind. And less than 10 years ago, Uruguay had no windmill at all. So this was a really rapid and radical transition. Not only the media is looking at the case of Uruguay, some specific research organizations looking at energy are showcasing Uruguay because apparently offers an examples that can be applied elsewhere and in many number of countries. This is not a perfect example. For instance, I really don't like the way the segment of generation, for instance, was open to a power, a private power provider, because there was no need for that. But what we can see is that the state is still the main actor in the Uruguayan transition. And here, for instance, we can see the change in installed capacity in wind power that, as I told you, it went from almost zero in 2008 to this figure 2 years ago, and the trend keeps going up. And this is because Uruguay had a long fight against privatization, and we won that battle, and we kept UTE, the equivalent of ESCOM, as a vertically integrated company that is financially autonomous. In fact, it generates revenue to pay back to the state to cover other basic social services. It is the monopoly actor in transmission, distribution, and retail of electricity, and is still the main actor in the generation sector. For instance, hydropower, which is the main source of energy in Uruguay, is 100% state-owned, and much of the recent investment in wind and in solar and in biomass has been done by the state. The other example is Costa Rica. As you know, Costa Rica is considered a model nation in terms of progressive environmental policy, not just in terms of energy policy. Costa Rica plans to become a carbon neutral country in less than 2 decades, and they are quite advanced already. And that's because they have a very efficient energy company, among other things. This is something that was produced by South African media that look at the case of ISE in Costa Rica as a possible example for ESCOM. And it's not easy to put ISE, this company, as an example for ESCOM, because the scale of Costa Rica and South Africa are quite different, and also the infrastructure behind the power sector in both countries are quite different. But still, in terms of looking at how a company can be restructured, keeping full public ownership and totally integrated, is a good example. And we see also in Europe, for instance, Corbyn, you have read in the news, has already committed to renationalize the energy network, looking at diverse energy ownership models. Labour is having a quite interesting discussion about how public ownership of the 21st century would look like. That maybe is not the kind of ESCOM that we had in the past. We need to think of new models of public ownership, different levels, including horizontal integration. I was going to give you an example of possible horizontal integration looking at the case of Costa Rica, but I don't have time for that. So I just want to say that in Costa Rica, for instance, we have a full state-owned national power sector that is the main actor, but at the same time we have a metropolitan public-owned electricity company, 2 municipal power utilities, and 4 rural cooperatives, and they work together. They don't compete. And they have a very interesting way of integrating generation, distribution, and commercialization, looking at the strength of all the different public actors without private intervention in the power system. So to finalize, I just want to show you some of the links that you might use in case you are more interested. The first one is the organization that Sean heads, TUET. This is the website of TUET. This is the one of TNI, tni.org. And finally, we just began a very ambitious research project funded by the European Union. We are a group of several universities, research centers, and community organizations from different European countries that are looking at the potentialities of the energy transition based on public ownership. We just began this project a few months ago, but we hope to have some real outcomes, outputs to show in the near future. And if you're interested, the website of that research project is this one, municipalpower.org. But it's not only about municipalities, it's about public ownership in a more general sense. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Daniel. I mean, I think that was quite a comprehensive input, specifically looking at the whole issue of wanting to push towards public ownership as opposed to private sector. I must say, I was quite, I'm sorry, I mean, usually when you do a presentation in such a short space of time, you're quite limited, but I was quite eager. I mean, you've given a sketch in relation to what's happening in Costa Rica and also the position in Uruguay, and I'm hoping in question time that people can tease out some of the actual nuances and draw lessons in terms of how we can actually take up our own contestation against the struggles that we need to take forward in terms of ESPA.
So, I think, comrades, I just want to ask if we limit the in and out as best as we can, because it's distracting for some, the in and out of the doors.
Okay, thanks. Thank you so much. I'm now going to hand over to Sean Sweeney. And as I said, he's the director, for trade, for the trade union.
For trade.
For trade union. And energy democracy, so welcome, comrade.
I'm the new Minister of Trade. Thanks for coming.
Okay.
Thanks for living.
Sure.
Thank you, and thanks everybody for being part of this important conversation. It dawned on me it's probably difficult to defend public ownership in South Africa right now, especially in the context of Eskom and what's going on. So as Daniel Chavez just said, I'm going to not spend too much time talking about what happened with Eskom, the whole state capture. But to say one thing, though, the proposal to break up Eskom was actually made almost 20 years ago. And there was a commitment made in 2002 to sell off 30% of Eskom's generation capacity and to unbundle it. This word is in the news now, but it was back in the news back in the early 2000s. Unbundling is a World Bank International Monetary Fund policy. It essentially says that unbundling itself doesn't do anything to improve the efficiency of a system, but it makes it ready for privatization. It makes discrete functions available for private sector to come in. Buying up a big state-owned utility that controls all the electricity section, that's generation, transmission, distribution, that is not a proposition private markets want to deal with. Too much money, too much risk. Plus, this is particularly true of South Africa, but it's true in many other countries, dilapidated infrastructure. So what I think we should focus on is not what's peculiar about Eskom, like who took money from whom, but what is going on around the global energy systems, particularly what is called the death spiral of the utilities. Now, for some environmentalists, when they talk about the death spiral of the big public or semi-public, or even privatized utilities, they like that story because they think it means that renewables are going to be coming in and breaking up these big systems. That's a narrative we have to struggle against because, first of all, it leads to major problems that the public as a whole will have to deal with. Daniel showed a picture of the little community with the windmills. We don't want to trash that. There's a role here in South Africa and all over the world for municipal, community-owned, or certainly community-managed energy systems. Because there is more opportunity now with solar and wind to do more distributed energy generation, which means we can have more democracy and more local control. The key difference, though, is not to put those systems in a competitive relationship with the existing systems, because this does a number of things. It throws the big systems into a crisis that we're living through every day here in South Africa. But it's not unique to South Africa. And so this death spiral thing is something that we have to have a little bit of a grasp and find out what happened and why. Now, just to say a little bit about the unbundling, then I'll get into a few more other points. The unbundling question, as I said, it doesn't actually do anything except break up. So this idea that then the individual components, generation, transmission, and distribution, are going to then, according to the policymakers here, the finance minister and the president said, so they can engage the private sector. What does that mean, engage the private sector? What we're seeing in the global situation right now is that energy systems pretty much anywhere on their own are unprofitable. This is the same as public transport systems. They nearly never make money because they're not, they weren't designed to make money in the first place. The logic of what the World Bank calls full cost recovery, that end users must cover the entire cost of the service plus the profit and dividends for shareholders, is there would never have been a public service if that logic had prevailed. I'll give an example from a country where I live in the United States. In the 1930s, in the mid-1930s, during the Depression, only 6% of farms in America had electricity. Private sector looked at the electricity, looked at the market and said, these people don't have a penny to scratch their ass with, put it crudely. They don't have a job. They can't, they're not very productive. And in fact, it's worth no point us trying to put any money investing into these rural areas. So we'll invest in the urban areas where people have money. This was also a global phenomenon. But in the US, the New Deal, which is sort of back on the agenda now in politics around the world, the New Deal said, no, if we provide electricity by borrowing money against ourselves, we can print money. We're the US, we print dollars. The South African government can print rand. It's an accounting question. Then you turn money into real productive activity. So what they did was this. They basically created the generation, started off with mainly big hydro from the Tennessee Valley Authority. Then they basically employed unemployed people who then set up the poles and wires. And within a 15 to 20 year period, that 6% went to 98% on literally very little money was put into it. Because then the productivity of the rural areas grew so dramatically that by 1960, some of the right wingers were saying, this is a distortion of the market. We can't provide all this cheap electricity because companies were moving from the coast into the rural areas because the electricity was cheaper. So this is a sort of the historical example that it's not a one-off. All of the rural electrification programs of the global south were modeled in one way or another, whether it's Mao Zedong's rural electrification in China or the big national development electrification systems. That was all done on that logic, that electricity is not just a right, it's a tool for human development and economic development. In South Africa, it took a very distorted form because most of the electricity was consumed and still to this day is consumed by big industrial and mining interests. 60%, you probably know this, of electricity is consumed in that way in South Africa. So it brings us to the question that if we had that logic before, that it's got to make money and it's got to satisfy investors, then we would never have had it in the first place. And if we go down that road now, it will end in tears, as it has done in other parts of the world. We're seeing in Europe, in Japan, in the United States, where they did privatize, when they did unbundling, there is an enormous deficit in investment. And the reason why is privatization supposedly introduces competition, but what it really does is introduce risk. And investors don't like risk. So how do they overcome the risk? They say to governments, if you want money, if you want our money, in our bank, in our banks or in our equity accounts, whatever it may be, if you want our money, you have to guarantee profit. That's the only way investment comes into the renewable sector. The International Energy Agency said last year, unsubsidized, market-based investment in renewable energy and low-carbon solutions has been virtually negligible. Let's take that fact and think about what that means. Without the guarantee of profit from the public purse through subsidies and all forms of generous financing, there would be no renewable energy sector anywhere in the world. That includes Germany or anywhere we look at the moment. So when we talk about, or when the government here talks about, we need to open it up to the private sector, what we're really saying is we are now going to package financing, we're going to guarantee revenues, guarantee profits, and then private sector interests might play a role in dealing with this. Now, this takes us to where the unions are in the debates right now. Because I believe there is a phenomenal opportunity in South Africa to move from defending Eskom as a public service to a radical new vision of a public utility. We can call it Eskom, a new Eskom, we can call it something else. It doesn't really matter. The prospect of that, I think, is very real, but we have to seize the debate. Because if it's just defending where things are now, because it's public and not private, I think we've already lost the argument. So then what are the components of this argument of a new Eskom and how it could be restructured? I think one of the things we have to say is that the next public utility in South Africa will be a completely different model, a completely different animal. First of all, we've got the reality of South Africa of abundant wind and solar potential. Having wind and solar potential doesn't mean you've got wind and solar electricity. There's a lot of steps that need to happen between that point and when it actually comes and turns on the lights. So what the government has done is gone through this independent power producer model, which has turned out to be hugely expensive. So it does a number of things. One is, it says the independent power producers are basically told that we will buy your power, your renewable energy, and I'm talking about IPPs in the renewable sector, we will buy your energy at an above market price, locked in for 20 years. So if you want to take issue, we can have a conversation about it afterwards. So they're buying the electricity at above market price over a period of a power purchase agreement of 20 years. And when this is on the margins of the system, 3, 4, 5 gigawatts or so, it's manageable. But when it gets bigger than that, all it does, or largely what it does, is it undercuts the capacity of Eskom. It loses market share. It can't pay its operating costs. It's in a bind with the... it's not the only problem they face. The rising coal costs on the world market are contributing to it, and it adds up to they can't recover the cost. Even if it was the best-run public utility in the world, and it is not, but if it was, it would still face problems. Those problems become our problems, because we now have an electricity system that can't function, and the IPPs have contributed to that. They're not the main reason, but they've contributed to it. So, but we do know that there is up to 70 gigawatts. Please, if you want to ask a question, you can be as pissed off with me afterwards if you want, but I'm trying to talk right now, so, you know, please, I'm open to any debate about this. You've got a capacity of up to 70 gigawatts of solar power and a comparable amount of wind power potential in South Africa. The question is, how do we deploy that? How do we bring that to scale in a way that doesn't have a messy, basically puts the Eskom, the public utility, and the whole infrastructure into a death spiral of neglect and all sorts of technical and other problems. So the way to do that is to say that we need to have a complete radical overhaul of the public utility. This, of course, would begin with, it's a big task, but it would begin with restoring the public ethic and some of the technical competencies to Eskom that, you know, should have been there in the past if they weren't, but they can be there in the future. So we've got people in there who are committed to public service. That would include very major input from unions, from communities, the municipalities, and so on. We need to have this radical overhaul if we're going to achieve what we need to do. But then the next question comes is then, if we're going to transition, and Brian's going to talk a little bit more about this in a moment, if we're going to transition to use that solar power, that wind power, and to promote energy conservation, the only way to do that is through a planned and coordinated approach based on a decade, 2 decades, 3 decades. This is not something that's going to happen overnight. And so what we need to do is reclaim the public utility, reform and democratize it, make everything completely transparent, and say, how do we move to more decentralized solar power? How do we deploy wind power into the system? The issue of when wind and solar comes into the system now in many parts of the world, it basically has two types of disruptive effects. One is it disrupts the market. The market then is based on every half hour the price changes. So when it's a sunny day and a windy day, the prices go down to virtually zero. Okay. But then what happens when the wind stops blowing and the sun stops shining? You've got problems where then you've got to go back onto the grid. So the centralized generators are saying, okay, you've put us in a situation we are on bankruptcy. You put us in a situation where we have loss of market share. You don't want wind, you don't want coal, gas, and nuclear, but you do want electrical power. So you better buy our power at above the market rate. So now in Europe, everybody is subsidized. Coal, gas, nuclear, and renewables. The same is true in the United States. All subsidized. Because if you lift it to the competitive dynamics of the market, which don't exist, but if you lift it to that, everybody would be largely bankrupt. It doesn't work. Electricity, it doesn't lend itself to this idea that we're all going to compete in this system and we're all going to sell electricity, whether it be at the community level, the corporation level, or in larger multinational corporations. A good example was what happened in Britain. The unbundling started there under Thatcher 30 years ago. Who bought the transmission system? British Gas made itself a private corporation. Some of the same people who had been public servants became capitalists. They went to the regulator, beware of the independent systems management operator that's being proposed here. You go to the regulator and say, oh, it's in such bad shape, we need to charge more for the electricity in order to pay for the new infrastructure. 30 years later, the opposition party wants to take it back. All it's done is take money out of the system. It's set up operations all over the world, and the system remains dilapidated. So what we've got is people who used it to strip assets and make money and not invest into the system. It's a complete failure. So the system of planning that needs to happen is we have in a new ESCOM, a new vision of a new ESCOM would say that yes, we have centralized coal that over a period of time, and as rapidly as possible, to be honest, will need to be phased out in an orderly way. That's the ecologically the best thing to do. It's the only thing to do to take advantage of South Africa's abundant solar power. But that has to be phased in over a period of years through the kind of planning we need to make sure that we can do that in a fairly orderly way. Now, what about the social ownership of renewables? Since I probably only have a couple more minutes. The unions here, pretty much all of them have keep ESCOM public. That's what they want. They understand that there are problems with ESCOM and they seek, and I think I can speak for pretty much all the unions, they seek a purging of ESCOM and the sort of the state state capture culture and also the sort of corrupt levels of the higher levels. That's absolutely essential. But they do believe in keeping it public. They also believe that it needs to be a transition from coal to renewables in an orderly and carefully planned way. And they also believe, more or less all of them, with social ownership of renewable energy. And social ownership of renewable energy is possible on a number of levels. First of all, the biggest single contributing cost to renewable energy is not the technologies. The biggest single cost is the borrowing of money. And when you've got private markets and the need for subsidies in order to grow yourself in that market, which is what an IPP is, power purchase agreements, when you've got that, you've got risk. And the investors look at that and they say, what is going to happen if you win the bid to provide power to the South African electricity system? The companies say, don't worry about it. We've got it here in writing. 20 years, our power will be purchased at this price. That lowers the risk. That means the investor will invest in the profit of of that company. But those costs then get passed on through the system to everybody else. We end up paying for that. Now, we can reduce those costs by basically public debt financing is a much less expensive way of financing public services. Governments don't go bankrupt, especially if you're South Africa and you can print rand. It's the same as the US, they can print dollars. We don't go bankrupt. We can find ways of raising money. So the risk is lower, which means the borrowing costs are lower. So that's an important fact. The other is the economies of scale. The more you do, the cheaper it gets. And so what we can do is cut out not just the costs of borrowing capital, which are very high in the private sector, but we can also lower the technology costs. And thirdly, there are costs of competition, which are when companies are competing against each other, putting in bids and so on, advertising, that all adds up to costs as well. None of those costs help us. None of those costs speed up the transition. So I think we're at a point where the vision of socially owned renewable energy would have to deal, yes, with supply chain question. We don't have a wind and solar industry in South Africa. But we're not talking about rocket science here. Solar panels are not that difficult to produce. They are glass and silica. Wind turbines, the only complicated thing about a wind turbine is really the generator. There's not much else that's particularly complicated about the basic wind turbine. Some of the big offshore ones now are 10, 20 megawatts, but we're not talking about offshore. We're talking about a mature technology that you could literally, if you can't produce it here, we purchase it at cost on the world market, then we generate electricity. But we have to control the system, we have to control the pricing, we have to control the revenue streams in order to do that. So I think this is a good time to have a very positive vision that in defending public ownership and a new ESCOM, we are not defending corruption, we're not defending inefficiency, we're not attacking the environment, and we're not just basically trying to protect the jobs of the workers in the industry, as important as that is. We're trying to build a new energy future for South Africa that would resonate not just here and in the region, but all over the world. Because the private approach, the neoliberal capitalist approach to driving renewable energy, has been a complete and utter failure. So there's a fantastic opportunity for South Africa to turn things around. It's going to be a heavy lift, but we've got unions who've got the basic positions on paper to support such a transition. If we can build allies in the social movements and in the communities built around that vision, then I think we've got a chance of turning the narrative away from the unbundling and the privatizing and the breaking up the public service and launching a completely new era in public energy in South Africa. So I'll stop on that one. Thanks.
Thank you, Sean, for that input. So just before I hand over to Brian, the director of AIGC, obviously the organization that's hosting us today, Ruth from LUMSA, tendered her apologies. She was unable to attend, so that actually she got her information from her, and she was going to be able to make a presentation, but unfortunately had to go to another meeting. And Sandra, who's actually from the, who worked with AIGC for the 1 Million Jobs campaign, but also PSI, another trade union representative, unfortunately cancelled that short break. So Brian's going to give us some, hopefully, some direction pulling from the two presentations, but I think more practically giving us a sense of what is it that we can do.
Sure. I don't know if I'm going to do all of those things, but since we're talking about power, Amandla! Amandla! Viva Eskom, viva! Unfortunately, not the enthusiastic response that I was hoping for, and perhaps I will put an argument or try to make the argument, and maybe by the end of the meeting we will be perhaps saying viva a new Eskom and forward Pambili new Eskom. But let me just contextualize the discussion that we're having. And that is deeply concerned with an extreme social crisis that we face in this country. A social crisis that is both economic and ecological. A transition to a low carbon economy is absolutely crucial. And we then have to identify the institutions and the social forces that can drive such a transition, because it's not going to happen because we say it should happen. And there are extremely powerful vested interests, big corporations, international institutions, the big energy intensive users in this country, the big mining corporations and so on, who are opposed to a transition to a low carbon economy. Now, Daniel highlighted a very important report that says to us, essentially, if we don't cut the emissions of these greenhouse gases coming from burning of coal, burning of gas, burning of oil, we are going to fry ourselves. We are got 12 years to halve the emissions of greenhouse gases that we pump into the atmosphere, Sasol and these coal-fired power stations that we have, most of which, these coal-fired power stations that are causing the ecological problems, the floods, the droughts, the acid mine water that we can't use and drink. All of these things are essentially caused by Eskom and its utilities, its power stations that are causing and the problems that we face. But not only that, of course people have heard about the whole way of Brian Malefi, how he ran Eskom into the ground, how Mr. Koko and other people were stealing, looting Eskom, etc. And so what they tend to do is they want to get rid of the dirt, the bathwater, but they end up throwing the poor baby out with their bathwater. And so what we've said is, actually, this public utility that has 50,000 people working for it, supplies 90% of our electricity or more. We've got to think about how we utilize this asset in order to serve our people's needs. Not the elites, not the corporates, but ordinary people's needs. And we have to do it with a great sense of urgency. We need this transition, not only because of the pollution caused by burning all of this coal to give us electricity or to give a few people electricity, because we must remember the energy poverty that we experience in this country. But we need to do it also because there's a massive opportunity. By moving to low carbon, in other words, producing our electricity through renewable energy sources, by getting polluting trucks off the road and carrying our people and freight by electrified transport, public transport, and expanding that public transport, taking buildings like this and making them energy efficiency, especially our RDP houses, putting ceilings in so they're not so damn hot in summer and frightfully cold in winter. What do? We create many, many jobs. And how many jobs do we need? Just like this, we need 10 million jobs in this country because we have 10 million people unemployed. I guess we need a lot more than 10 million jobs because many of the people who are counted in jobs are some of those people you see on the corner of the street, some of us maybe, selling that funny money. If you're selling funny money, you're not considered as unemployed. Any kind of survivalist activity, you're not registered as unemployed. Many women in the Bantustans, the former Bantustans, I still call them Bantustans because of the extreme impoverishment and inequality that is in these areas. Many of these women who are labeled in the statistics as housewives, homemakers, are actually unemployed women. So the unemployment crisis is extreme. And what is the impact of that unemployed employment crisis? That unemployment crisis is behind the terrible fear that we have when we get into the taxi to go home just now, and when we reach our place, will we be knife against our throats, our cell phone taken, etc. Because behind the crime is violence, it's crime, it's abuse of women, etc. So the urgency of the unemployment crisis says we have to break with the current economic strategy that we have. And so AIDC, together with several other formations, have been working on a plan to say, well, how can we create sufficient jobs to deal with the social and economic and ecological crisis? Because we've got to deal with the economic crisis we've got, but we've also got to deal with the problem of climate change. We can't put our heads under the sand and say, oh God, we've got to save our jobs in the coal sector at all costs and not think about the issue of climate change. So how do we deal with the real problem that many workers, and you saw that, last year played by the, was it last year or the year before? Played by the Eskom mafia when they wanted to protect the coal industry at all costs. They played the unions and said, you're going to lose your jobs because of us bringing in renewable energy. So we mobilized, and they managed to mobilize coal truckers. They managed to mobilize NUMSE and NUM to come out against renewable energy. But behind that were real concerns that those workers were facing. So the question is, comrades, we need a transition. We can't stay where we are, but nor can we throw millions of people or several hundreds of thousands more people onto the streets when we have this terrible unemployment crisis. And when we have a massive opportunity of creating at least 1 million jobs that help to bring down these emissions of greenhouse gases that are causing all the environmental problems. So at the back, there's several booklets of AIDC on the Million Climate Jobs Campaign that set out where these jobs are. But one of the things that I want to talk to is that if we are going to have a credible strategy to deal with the problems, the environmental problems and the economic problems, etc., we can't suck things from our thumbs. We need a real coherent plan and strategy that we can put there that has scientific basis to it. And so we said in September last year, we said, listen, there's a deep crisis in Eskom. Are we going to run along and throw the baby out with the bathwater and then in 10 years or 20 years time come back to the crisis that people are facing in other parts of the world where they've liberalized, they've opened up the energy sector, which is currently in this country monopolized, completely monopolized, but at least it's owned by a state company. The state company, not many people said Viva earlier on because of all the problems that we have. But as I argue, we shouldn't say that is not reformable. It's not something that we can transform. In fact, it is something that we have to transform. Otherwise, we end up in the crisis of deeper impoverishment because a liberalized and unbundled Eskom is going to have no concern for the small electricity users who need to be subsidized in being able to get electricity. None of us here can afford the cost of more and more expensive electricity. So we need a national, publicly owned thing that we own and our taxpayers' money is contributing towards. And so we've got to come up with this plan, and we're doing the study, drawing on international experience, incorporating the unions that are going to be affected, and hopefully we can come up with an credible alternative to the one that the Eskom board is putting forward now, which is basically cutting off their own foot, cutting off their own nose. An alternative to what Ramaphosa is suggesting of breaking up Eskom into three parts. One part, a company that is going to generate the electricity. Another part that is going to transmit the electricity to different parts of the country. And a third part that is going to distribute it to the companies, premises, the houses, etc., etc. Because behind that is the credible fear that that is going to lead to greater input of the private sector. And when the private sector enters the market, what happens? The motive is not answering our need, but answering the pockets, the profits. Okay? That is what they're going to be interested in. And that is going to be a big, big disaster. Tariffs will go up. The cost of electricity will go up. And more people will be made redundant. And we've got to fight that. But we can't fight it by simply saying we don't like privatization. We can't fight it simply by saying we must defend our jobs. We've got to put a credible plan together. Part of the credible plan is saying, addressing one of the big motives, or at least the selling point about unbundling. Because a major part of unbundling is the debt spiral that Sean speaks about is the debt crisis of Eskom. 420 billion rand of debt. That's one third of the current budget of South Africa, isn't it? One third of our budget. It's so big that Eskom is no longer able to service that debt. The people lending to Eskom are saying, we actually don't trust you to pay back your debt. We're going to rate your debt as not very sound. And so if you're going to get other people to lend to you, you're going to have to pay bigger interest costs. Now, do you know that Eskom's total interest payments plus its principal payments in 2018 amounts to something like 70 billion rand. Every year, Eskom goes into a bigger and bigger debt. It is simply taking out new loans in order to service its current debt. So in a few years' time, Eskom will be finished, completely finished. So we've got to come up with a credible idea of how we can solve the debt problem of Eskom. And we're saying at AIDC, one of the things that we must do, we must go not to the private banks, not to the international financiers to service Eskom's debt. Actually, there is a source, a pool of money that we can draw on. And that pool of money actually is owned by government. There is a thing called the Public Investment Corporation. This Public Investment Corporation manages public sector workers' monies, their pension monies. Now, the scale of the assets of this Public Investment Corporation is something like 2 trillion, just over more than 2 trillion rands. 2 trillion rands, that's 2,000 billion rand. It's a huge amount. And we're saying, take some of that money and use it to manage Eskom's debt. And we say that not to impoverish public sector workers and their pensions. I'll give you the numbers. I don't want to scare you with all the math, etc. But just look at this. I'll give you the numbers, all right? What's going into this, the government employees pension fund, which is the biggest component of the Public Investment Corporation. From the members themselves, from the workers, every month a certain amount of money is taken off to go to their pension. And government contributes a similar amount. The total per year of that contribution is 70 billion rand. Then there is this Brian Malefi also used to, by the way, manage the Public Investment Corporation. And he invested that money in private companies to really fast-track black economic empowerment. And you know the problems of that. I'm not going to talk about it. But the interest or the dividends share coming from their investments in these private companies, listed and unlisted, is another 30.6 billion rand. And then the interest from the lending that this fund does, it lends to Eskom, by the way, it lends to the government, etc., is another 44.6 billion rand. So every year, there's an equivalent of 145 billion rand going into the fund. Guess how much they have to pay to the workers who have retired. The pension payments are there. It's about 95 billion rand. So that means there's a 50 billion surplus every year. And this fund grows and grows and grows and grows. And what are we doing with that surplus? We're investing it in corrupt BEE, Iqbal's, IO Technologies, MTN. You know the stories, right? Why not use those surpluses and invest in the Eskom debt and save, because the return on investment of PIC's money is not so great. It's about 5%. So they invest all this money in these companies and so on, and they invest in these loans, and accumulated interest on all of that is 5% of what is invested. Eskom pays its creditors 10%. So we could say to the pension fund, to PIC, we'll give you 7.5%. We'll save 2.5%, right? We'll save 2.5% on our borrowing costs and reduce the total debt. But there are many other instruments that are available for us to deal with the problem of Eskom's debt. There is, of course, 1.5 trillion rand of big corporations sitting in bank accounts doing nothing. So why doesn't government do what the apartheid government did and say, hang on, chaps, we'd like you to invest in nationally prioritized things. Like, we want a national health system. We want land reform. We want a decent Eskom. We're going to impose on you and say 10%. You should invest a proportion of that in these nationally determined, state-driven investment projects of ours. And we'll give you a 5% return interest. We're not going to take your money, which is what I would probably propose, but we'll give you an interest rate. We're not expropriating you yet. But we are going to give you, and again, it would release a massive amount of resources to deal with the Eskom problem, thereby undercutting the rhetoric that the reason we have to do this, we have no alternative, because there's no plausible way of dealing with the debt crisis in Eskom. I'm simply using this as a means to show that there are many different alternatives to unbundling and privatizing of Eskom. And let me end by saying this. There is one big problem with the argument that the three of us are making. It is the total skepticism that we have to this state and to the deep corruption and dysfunctionality of the state. So I can see Bruce there already championing on his thing and say, look at the problems in PRASA. Look at the problems in Transnet, etc. You want us to give more money to these corrupt managers, etc.? No. But let's not confuse tasks. We've got to deal with reforming the public sector. We've got to find a way of building a capable state. But don't throw the baby out with the bathwater. Thank you.